Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So we are, Marlene, we're getting into that time of year where the conferences are coming in, you know, hard and fast. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but there's one that we wanted to kind of highlight this week, which is a fantastic conference coming up in June that, you know, may be flying below some people's radar. So we wanted to kind of get someone on here to highlight it and talk to one of our fellow legal tech geeks in the world here to tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so we'd like to welcome Richard Tromans from Artificial Lawyer and conference creator and chair of Legal Innovators UK and California. Richard, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Thanks, Molly. Thanks, Greg. Pleasure to be here.
So I know you're on sabbatical at the moment, but for those listeners who may not be familiar with Artificial Lawyer, can you talk about your work there over the years?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you the short version. So I got into the legal world in 1999, which seems like several lifetimes ago now. I joined as the international reporter of a magazine called Legal Week, which was eventually bought by American Lawyer Media and has been folded in to law.com. I left that, incredibly, almost 20 years ago. And then had a career across Europe. I was a foreign correspondent for a different magazine. Then I came back to London and I became a strategy consultant, working with Thomson Reuters, with Hildebrandt and Baker Robbins. Then I joined an M&A boutique in London where we used to merge law firms together. And one of my key jobs was to analyze trends and market movements, sort of big, sort of high level, you know, where's the market going? And that's kind of how I got into legal tech. I had one of the last papers I wrote for the market was mostly aimed at managing partners and large law firms in the US and UK, touched on AI. And that was in sort of about 2015. I didn't really know where it was going, but then I left and I set up my own business, Tromans Consulting, which does kind of strategy, innovation, blah, blah, blah. And I thought the best way to learn about the subject, because I knew nothing about legal tech, absolutely nothing. At that point, I could name two legal tech companies, and I wasn't even really quite sure they were legal tech companies.
<That's right.
laughs> despite having been in the legal market for years and years and years and years, I'd been dealing with business aspects, you know, profits per equity partner, where should we open an office, should we do a merger, you know, it was just business, that was the focus, not technology. And I wanted to learn. I thought a good way to learn about technology is to write about it. So I started a blog called Artificial Lawyer. And it was a real, you know, like $1 kind of blog. You know, I bought a domain name. I got a WordPress site and I started it up. And totally without any planning, to my complete surprise, it just exploded. It just took off completely. Within a couple of weeks, I was getting thousands and thousands of hits, and I was getting invited to speak left, right, and center, because that was like the first wave of legal AI,
right?
Mostly driven by what you might call natural language processing, or at least the first version of natural language processing. Well, to the AI experts in the audience, it was probably the third or fourth or fifth iteration, but
right,
to many in the legal market, it was really the first time it really got to grips. They were meeting companies like, you know, Kira and Luminant, eBrevia, Seal, the big two, Thomson Reuters and LexisNexis, were trying to get their heads around it. LexisNexis bought up smaller, much more, well, infinitesimally smaller companies who were going down that road to bring them in. Thomson Reuters decided to build it itself. And the market was just exploding. And it's so funny because what was happening in 2015, 2016 is exactly what's happening now. Everyone's going completely bananas about LLMs and AI, right?
Right.
ChatGPT and all the others.
Yeah, we've heard a few things about that.
You know, it's just like a deluge. And the funny thing is that it was very, very, very similar. I mean, that you had the end of lawyers debates, you had privacy and security and risks and how accurate is it and what effect will it have and will this change the business model and all those types of things. And it's really funny. It's like a deja vu. The difference this time is that I actually believe it's real this time. The last 6 years in some ways, and it has been real, but it hasn't been transformative. the natural language processing has found its way into many, many, many products, from e-discovery to due diligence to legal research, litigation analytics and prediction, all types of legal tech tool. But it hasn't been absolutely transformative. It hasn't really changed the business model. This time around, I think it actually will. I think it will really have an impact. But equally at the same time, I'm kind of glad that I'm on a sabbatical at the moment, because we're in that very, very early phase of the wave where there are just millions and millions of announcements. It's very frothy. There's a lot of stuff that's insubstantial. And I think it's going to shake itself out. But this time, I really do think it's going to make a difference.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have to buckle up when you get back off sabbatical.
Well, I mean, I think sabbatical is a great to kind of gives you the opportunity to digest a lot of this and think a lot about this, you know, before kind of stepping into the fray.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm meant to be writing a book, but at the moment, all I'm doing is promoting my my conference. But
Speaking of which, that's why we asked you on the show. So you have the upcoming California Legal Innovators Conference. It's happening in San Francisco in early June. I think it's June 7th and 8th.
That's right.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about the Legal Innovators California Conference and what the overall mission is?
Yeah, sure. I think it's twofold. So, well, let me just take a little step back. So, first of all, Legal Innovators is a conference series that we started a few years ago in London, and it's grown incredibly well in the UK. And then just before the COVID hit, we decided to launch one in California, and we decided San Francisco is the logical place to do it because, you know, Silicon Valley, lots of big law firms, lots of innovation, tons of stuff happening there. And then COVID hit and it got delayed for about 2 years. And we finally did the first one last year in June 2022, which was our start. It was a good start. Got some great speakers. And so this year is effectively the second time we've done it. And we've expanded it to 2 days, as you noted. So day one is law firms and ALSPs, alternative legal service providers. Day two is in-house and legal ops. And the idea of that is, even though we're going to have a lot of overlap in the audience, probably I would guess 80, 90% will probably be on both days. The idea is it allows speakers to sort of drill down, because clearly running a legal team inside a corporate is quite different to working in legal innovation inside a law firm. It's very, these are very, very different approaches in many ways, and it allows people to do that. It's kind of like a safe space. So, you know, yeah. The in-house lawyers and the legal ops people can kind of, they can talk about their world and the lawyers can talk about their world. It's, and also we can learn from each other.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, to your point that I bet you'll have people stay the whole time just because they want to hear, you know, what interests people, you know, what are they doing on, you know, both in legal operations and also in law firms. So first day of conference, focus on private practice, ALSPs. So can you tell us a little bit more about the topics and themes that'll be covered, and what can the attendees expect to learn?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, as mentioned, it's kind of twofold, because there's an educational aspect, and I think also there's a sharing aspect. I mean, for me, the only reason why I do this, the only reason why I started Artificial Lawyer, the only reason why I do these events is because I quite, you know, earnestly want to see a change in the business of law globally, both in the US, UK, around the world. And to me, even though, you know, you might say there are financial incentives, etc., if there isn't a purpose to this, there is no point in doing it. I mean, I've got a mission, and I'm trying to engage with other people who also have a mission. And I see that in lots of people involved in the industry, whether it's in-house or law firms or, you know, in the tech sector or ALSPs, you know, they're running a business, but they are trying to change the world in their own way as much as they can. You know, there's a broader goal. You know, they're not just, you know, hey, let's hit X revenue, or let's make the partners 2% richer this year, or, you know, there's a deeper driving force in all of this. And I think that's, to be honest, I mean, that's fundamentally what it's all about. So anything that moves the needle, anything that drives us forward. So educationally, people will be sharing experiences. There's going to be plenty about generative AI. So we've got speakers such as Dan Katz. As you know, he's one of the first people, I think he actually was the first person to use an LLM to pass the bar exam, which got a lot of headlines, but he's done so much more since then. Also looking at the bigger picture as well, like Maya Markovich, who's very interested in justice tech, because also, I mean, what is the point in all of this, in any of this, if we're just going to help like 5% of corporate America or corporate Europe? It's really, it's not enough. We need more. There has to be a bigger benefit. And so access to justice tech, whatever you want to call it, that has to be part of the picture. You know, it has to be, because there has to be a broader outcome. On the legal ops and in-house side, in some ways, I think actually the pendulum has swung back now. I mean, most of the legal tech focus for years and years was on the law firms, and it's really swung back now, I think, to in-house. Because, and I think actually in-house is really embracing change in a way that they didn't. I think in the past, and some GCs may be unhappy for me to say this, but I think a lot of it was just lip service in the past, and very little actually changed. I think now, I think the gloves are off. I think they actually will do something. I think their interest in ALSPs is genuine. I think the financial pressures are genuine. And I think also the broader market knowledge is filtering upwards. People, you know, in the C-suite, the CFO, the CEO, investors even, you know, shareholder activists, big funds, you know, BlackRock, whoever. They're starting to see so much stuff about legal tech, legal innovation, about change management, that they're starting to go, hold on a minute, why are we doing anything here? We can really do something. So this isn't just about shaving off a couple of percentage points on the, you know, the day-to-day work inside a corporate on the legal side. This is about sort of transformational stuff. And this is why the AI piece really comes in nicely. And that links also up with the ALSPs. So it's all about changing the business of law, changing the business model. So you might say that's the educational bit. So there's that bit about sort of understanding the bigger picture, where we're going. And then I think the second part is just personal experiences, because everybody, or well, nearly everybody at the conference will probably have had some personal experience, whether trying and failing, or trying and succeeding, or wanting to try but not being allowed to try, or going off and just doing their own thing, building their own tech company, or building a consultancy, or creating an ALSP, or whatever it is, or changing roles inside a company. And I wrote a piece just before I went on sabbatical about the legal innovation ecosystem. And it really is an ecosystem, because there are so many paths, so many branches. You know, you start off with, you know, as a baby lawyer, and you go to a big law firm, and then you realize, oh my God, I don't want to do this anymore. When you go in-house, and you're like, I don't want to do this either. So you move to a legal ops role. When you come out of that, maybe you join a legal tech company. Maybe then you leave that and you create your own and you make a ton of money. And then you become an investor, but then you get invited to be a law professor, or I don't know, like an honorary, you know, law professor or something. And on and on and on, the roles keep changing and jumping around. And, you know, the information just is shared and built upon. There's like this cross-fertilization across the market. And eventually it builds up and it builds up and the silos break down. You just get to this critical mass. And I think that's where we are now. And that's why it's so exciting. And that's why I'm very excited about Legal Innovators, because you're bringing all these people together in person to share that. And you have energy and all that information and the direction that you're bringing together there. You know, it's really extraordinary. And it's a great time to be in legal tech.
Yeah. I mean, we obviously agree. One of the sessions is going to be about the law firm of the future. Appropriately, you know, and what do you see as the biggest challenges facing law firms in terms of adapting to new technology and innovation, and how can they overcome them? You mentioned like in-house seems to be embracing this a little bit more. So what are the challenges that law firms have?
Well, I would say that they're embracing it more than the law firms. I think it's just that they're starting to embrace it, but there's a difference. If a seller changes, if a law firm changes just, you know, a little bit, doesn't have much of impact on the rest of the market, except it may impact some of its competitors who feel compelled to do similar things. If the buyers change even a microscopic amount, the leverage of that is 1,000 times. So if the large banks and the large Fortune 500 companies in America suddenly went, hey, you know what, the billable hour is in fact now going to be the minority of our work that we pay for externally, not the majority. It'll be the really, really odd jobs, unusual jobs. Then you have to have fixed fees. You have to have productized services. At that point, lawyers in law firms, the partners who are very, very smart, immediately will go, hold on a minute. If we work as we work now, we're all going to be bankrupt. We need as much technology. We need as much efficiency as possible. And that's the only way we're going to stay rich and powerful and connected and important. So we're just going to monster efficiency. We're going to invest in innovation like never, ever, ever before. And that's why I think, going back to that point about the last 6-7 years in some ways, has been like a dummy run.
Yeah.
It's been like a dress rehearsal. Because the fundamentals of the legal market have not changed. I wrote a piece on LinkedIn a while ago when ChatGPT kind of exploded, saying, you know, everyone's saying this is a game changer. It's not a game changer unless the game changes. The game has not changed. The billable hour dominates.
Uh-huh.
In-house lawyers are still incredibly reluctant to shift the model, to put their foot down and change things, to challenge things. But this is the thing, it's a bit like all revolutions. I mean, if you think about, you know, look at the American Revolution and social change in America, civil rights movements, you know, women's suffrage, right to vote, all these things, they build up over centuries. Somebody says, this isn't right in like 1600. And then every few decades, somebody else writes another book, there's a demonstration, they get hung, drawn and quartered, and, you know, they're wiped out from history, and then someone else comes along. And then eventually, the right conditions emerge, and bang, something actually happens. And I think it's very, very hard to tell. Maybe this is going to be another false dawn, right? Maybe what's happening now is just more preparation. Maybe, but maybe not. Maybe this is the real thing. Maybe the next 5 to 6 years I actually can see real transformation. So Marley, to answer your question,
you see, you're already doing the crystal ball question.
Everything is pivotal on this point. If LLMs are another dress rehearsal and the clients don't really change how they demand work is done, and the shareholders don't care about wasting literally billions upon billions of dollars of money every year for work that doesn't need to be done in that way, if that just carries on, trundles on, everyone in the legal media just keeps churning out press release after press release, blah, 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 blah. We have lots of conferences. It all basically is just everyone scratching each other's back, and we do nothing of any real substance. It will have all just been a dress rehearsal, complete waste of time. I was going to use an Anglo-Saxon phrase, but I won't. I'll keep this polite because I know this is a family
show. I was going to say, do we need to put a adult-only content on this one?
Parental advisory, you know, like we used to do on that music. And this is the thing, and yet that is why it's so tantalizing, because we could be on the cusp of something really significant. We could equally be on a scenario where it's just a ton more window dressing.
Well, it definitely feels like real change, but I guess, as with everything, only time will tell on that. So, Richard, on day two of the conference, we're going to switch gears and you're going to focus on in-house legal teams for the day. Can you tell us a little bit more of what you're going to focus in on with the in-house?
Yeah, it's effectively the same thing. We're going to talk about AI. We're going to talk about alternative legal service providers, and it's interesting to note that about half of the sponsors of the events, we've got quite a few already, half of the sponsors are actually ALSPs or ALSP-like businesses,
right,
which is extraordinary, really, because I've never been part of a conference where half of the sponsors were ALSPs. And I think that tells you something about what's changing in America as well,
uh-huh,
which is great. So they'll be talking about that. Legal ops, where are we now? I mean, legal ops in some ways has been sort of like talked through and back out the other end again. I mean, it's kind of almost like burn the subject down a bit. But I think perhaps, again, it goes back to AI. I think, you know, I think this the new reality of what can be done will hopefully re-energize the debate and the conversation. And I think also, I mean, you know, obviously no one wants to see a recession. But the big first wave of, you know, really quite sophisticated tools around automation and AI, to some degree, you could argue, came out of the 2008 financial crash. If it hadn't been for that, it wouldn't have been this beginning of what people call the new normal, right? You know, like CFO is walking down the corridor for the very first time to meet the GC. Why do we spend all this money? Can you please explain? And the GC having to go, what you actually want me to tell you why we spend what we spend? And they're going, yeah, basically, yeah. If you could, that would be pretty handy. And if you could
reduce it a little. Such a novel concept.
That would, you know, where it won't reduce, where it won't increase our risks, that would be absolutely awesome. And so began the new normal, which I think underpinned, whether consciously or unconsciously, a lot of what came with legal tech then. You know, it really gave it an economic impetus. And the current kind of doldrums that the Western economies are in, again, I think is really significant. And also, look at the big tech companies in California. They're laying off tens of thousands. And look at Twitter, for example. It laid off, what, 3/4 of its workforce. And I know they've had a few problems, but they've just realized they can still function. Although some people would argue they're not really
despite those problems.
Well,
yeah, you might get some argument there.
But I think the thing is I think a lot of the big companies are reassessing what they spend money on. And that's tremendously exciting if you're interested in innovation, because for me, economics and innovation go hand in hand. The two are not separate. I mean, another Elon Musk business, but look at SpaceX. Why is SpaceX so successful? Because it found a way to bring back the launchers, which saves huge amounts of money. It's not just the innovation of making launches that come back down again. It's the fact that they're saving the money. The cost-saving aspect is totally connected to innovation. And, I mean, it'll be very, very interesting to see if the in-house people really are embracing that or perhaps not. Again, you know, I've been disillusioned so many times by possibilities of real change. And then people saying, well, actually, we don't really care. So, you know, let's all be honest. There's no point pretending, is there? I mean, God, I mean, how many conversations about change and revolution, you know, in the field of legal tech are there? And you come back a year later and nothing has really changed. So, yeah. I'm really excited. I think we've got a great bunch of people building a good audience, some really interesting subjects. But I think fundamentally, I think this is a great opportunity to talk about genuine change.
Well, let's jump in on a couple of topics on the second day. And I think, and Marlene, I think you've got this question, but I think this runs parallel to your SpaceX example of if you can reduce the cost in one area, it can exponentially expand some of the other things. So like we had Darth Vaughn from Ford on a couple of weeks ago, and he mentioned, he's like, look, I don't lack for legal problems that I need outside counsel to help me with. What I lack for is time and money to get to all of these projects. And so if you can figure out ways to do that. But I think, you know, one of the sessions, and Marlene, you want to take this one on change management?
Well, yeah, we wanted to sort of dive a little bit deeper into this based on sort of some of the things you're saying. There is a focus, one of the sessions on change management and, you know, how to implement successful change. You know, wanted to get your thoughts on, like, what are some of the challenges that in-house legals teams face when they're trying to implement this?
It boils down to them actually wanting to do it. I mean, I've worked as a management consultant for years and years, and, you know, aside from doing Artificial Lawyer, the media site, you know, I've advised, you know, obviously with other people, not just myself, some of the largest law firms in the world. And it always boils down to the same thing. I mean, my boss, as it were, at the time when I was working in the City of London, he basically said, you know, there are two kinds of jobs. There are the jobs where they pay you a ton of money and take the report and put it in their desk drawer and never look at it again, even though the whole partnership is just voted on approving it. And the one where they pay you a lot of money and they actually do something. He was quite open about it. The vast majority of cases, they don't do anything about it. they pick the smallest, easiest aspect on page 27 and go, mm-hmm. okay, let's do that bit, because that's the only bit that we can do that we feel comfortable with in the version they've agreed it. I think that's a problem. Change management, you know, as I'm sure all of your other guests have said, is incredibly hard. It's really hard, and you need real leadership. And I think the in-house legal function is such an interesting area because it's so important to the business. It's like the life support system, really, in many ways. You know, if in-house goes down, particularly in the US, which is so, you know, so much litigation and so forth, you know, it's an existential threat to the business. And yet at the same time, it's kind of like second-guessed by the C-suite. Because if the C-suite doesn't say to the GC, I want to see a 25% cut year on year, like they might say to the logistics team, you know, the head of logistics, if they don't deliver what the C-suite wants, they will be sacked by the end of the year. You know, no gold parachute, just bye-bye, get out of here. There's your box, off you go, right? When was the last time a GC got sacked for not shaving off enough money from legal spend? I probably never in history. And, you know, I'm not saying that should happen. Innovation is all about economics. And yet, simultaneously, we're living in an environment where the most powerful, important people in the room, the buyers, are not under the same kind of economic pressure that you would get in other departments in a large business. It's very, very weird. I mean, I've grappled with this for years, and I must admit, it's infuriating because, you know, it's like if we weren't in legal tech, if we were in, let's say, all three of us, the audience, we were all working in logistics, there would be no debate here. It would just be like, oh, that's quicker and faster and better and cheaper than that thing. Right, let's just do it. And anyone who objected to it, you would look like you were completely mad, right? Yeah. Whereas in law, you can easily just say, no. I don't think we should be going faster, cheaper, better, quicker, whatever.
Yeah. In fact, you're more likely to get fired by going
for that
than to stick to the traditional gun. So yeah, that I imagine, you know, the old saying of no one got fired for buying IBM, you know, back in the day. It's not many GCs are going to get fired for hiring Kirkland and Ellis or somebody. Yeah, you might get fired for IBM today.
And yet, but I suppose, this is the thing, you see. I mean, you know, that's the other thing, is the complexity and the sheer range of legal compliance tasks that a large corporate has to handle now is just exponentially bigger than it was, say, 50 years ago, when the idea of having sizable in-house legal teams first started to evolve. I mean, the quantity and the complexity of legal matters is just mind-boggling, and also global now. I mean, you know, a large US corporate isn't just operating in 3 or 4 American states, it's operating across the entire planet. You know, it's not even operating just in the physical world, it's operating in the virtual world, it's operating in the digital realm, it's operating in all different kinds of levels. How does a corporate triage that, break it up and say, okay, this bit does need to go to Kirkland and Ellis, this bit does deserve to have second year associates being paid $1,000 $1,000 an hour to proofread these documents? Yeah, who cares? It's life and death. It's right. Like 2% of all the legal work we do. Doesn't matter. But what about the other 98% where actually this is not life and death? It's right. Just really gnarly. The processes, we don't even know our own processes. I was called up for a consulting job. I won't mention their name, obviously, but it was a very large, it was a global bank. They contacted me. They wanted me to help. And I said, well, let's start off brass tacks, foundation level. Could you describe what you actually do as a legal department in this bank? And they said, well, no, we don't actually know what we do. We, you know, we get up, we work really hard. We're always really busy. Some stuff we can't handle and it goes out. And then, you know, we go to bed, we wake up the next day and it happens all over again. I said, well, you know, first of all, one, I'm just by myself. There's no way I can help you. But I ended up referring them out to a very large law firm that had a consulting group. And I said, but look, you know, before you even go down that road, you've got to know what you actually do. What are your processes? You know, where do you keep your precedence? How do you choose who does what? How do you divvy up work? They had like none of that. Everything was just this like organic kind of blancmange, like a mushroom. It's like kind of a big fungus that had kind of grown out of the side of this corporate. And they were all quite merry and, you know, really nice people. And But they were aware that something was going terribly wrong, but they couldn't really tell you what it was. And this is the thing, it's like there was no oversight. The CEO and the CFO were not coming down and saying, "This is terrible. What on earth are you doing?" They were just thinking, well, these people prevent us from dying on a monthly basis. Let's just leave them to it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's the entire industry is systemically disincentivized from change. And I guess if Legal Innovators California, Legal Innovators London, and Artificial Law can do anything to help change that by lending support, moral support, publicity to those who are trying to change things, whether inside organizations or outside, then, you know, I mean, hopefully it's all for a greater good.
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of hot areas here, and I think you're covering both of those at the end of day two, which is there's a lot of adoption, and it's like before generative AI all of a sudden hit in January, the big talk has always been on, you know, lifecycle management systems that are out there, and then the other being ALSP. So that's how you're wrapping up the day. Is the lifecycle management systems, are they still a huge topic right now, or do you think that there's going to be some AI involved in leveraging this? And so what's your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the CLM companies, I guess, are now entering their third era. The first era, they were body shops, right? Thousands of people sitting in warehouses in India, the Philippines, or wherever, all spread out across Europe and the US, or a mix of all of those, handling the contracts for large corporates. On a very basic level, or just doing lots and lots of almost like e-discovery type work that focus on the contractual side. They were like incredibly inefficient. They were effectively just cheaper versions of a management contract management system or department. Then people started to use natural language processing. So, you know, organizations like ContractPod AI started to bring in AI, surprisingly, by then, though. And things started to get more efficient, but they were still pretty much, in many ways, body shops. And I think now with LLM technology, things really are going to change because, you know, if you're a large corporate, you can either build your own LLM, or there are definitely ways now that you can securely link effectively your entire corpus, whether financial, legal, to an LLM. And with the right prompt engineering and right management and risk control, you'll have total control over it. At that point, you then have to ask, and like the CLM companies will shoot me for saying this, but you do really have to ask, where are they heading? Because many of them are built on a worldview where this wasn't possible. Well, I just had lunch before I just came here for this call. I just had lunch with a guy who's building this really cool doc automation tool. Really, it works in a different way to almost everybody else. It's really original. But I said to him, like, you know, when this finally launches and you're ready to launch, will it be part of a world that is now part of the LLM era or not? Is it like 1920 and you've just built the fastest stagecoach in the world, right? Horse-driven stagecoach. But nobody wants one because everyone's driving cars now. It's, you know, you've done some beautiful innovation. Well done, you know, Congratulations. Sorry, but it's actually now irrelevant. And I think that's one of the challenges is that if you think about it, over the last few years, lots of legal tech companies have been given tens of millions of dollars in VC cash to develop tools that fit a world that may not exist in 2 years because we'll be in a different environment. And their entire engineering team, all of their product focus, their marketing, their sales, their relationships with clients, is all built on a world that possibly, quite genuinely, quite possibly, won't exist in 2 years.
I want to follow up on Greg's question about the panel on ALSPs. You know, we're sort of talking about how change, you know, where we're basically these companies are sort of developing things that, you know, in a couple of years just may be irrelevant. So let's sort of take that theme and apply it to the ALSPs. You know, are they ever going to eat law firms' high volume lunch? And how do you consider the roles of ALSPs evolving in the legal industry? And what are the key considerations for in-house legal teams when deciding to use them?
Yeah, brilliant question. I mean, the ALSP thing, I think, is in some ways is equally as important as the AI one. I think they are equally weighted. I think the future of ALSPs, whether they're in-house law firm entities, so, you know, a law firm, you know, whether it's a large or a small one, has effectively built their own ALSP, or it's an independent freestanding ALSP, or it's an ALSP that belongs to the Big Four, right? It doesn't matter what type of ALSP they are. In fact, some corporates have actually built their own ALSPs. So like British Telecom built their own in the UK, you know, its own little ALSP unit that serviced itself. It doesn't matter where they are in the ecosystem. The key aspect is, will they remain body shops? And of course, ALSPs are the two types. You've got the lawyers on demand. I imagine the high grade lawyers on demand side will carry on as usual, the axioms, so forth. If you're a large corporate and you go, hey, you know, we're in a merger, we need 10 extra people with 7 years PQE, that probably won't change. On the higher volume, on the repetitive work, on the sort of complex but at scale stuff, where we are basically, so, you know, we're talking about, you know, sophisticated body shop type approaches, the question then is, do they embrace tech or not? And the problem is, you see, a lot of the ALSPs, and again, I'll probably get shot for saying this, are specialized versions of law firms. They bill out by the hour. They work often hand in hand with a law firm. The law firm has its business model. The ALSP is using almost an identical business model, but is cheaper. And certain types of work will go in that way. The more sophisticated ALSPs are doing fixed fees or success fees or other AFAs. They're using a lot of technology. They've got their own consulting groups. They've got their own legal ops groups, which make them almost a bit more like the Big Four. They're more sophisticated. But again, it all boils down to the same thing. Will they really embrace technology? No.
Yeah.
And will the GCs ask for it? Rationally, I would say that about 20% of the US legal market, commercial legal market, could easily be handled by ALSPs, which would mean that the total value of ALSPs in America would be, what, we're talking in tens of billions, yeah?
Yeah.
Tens of billions of revenue per year. Tens and tens of billions of, years, mm-hmm. Of dollars. We're nowhere near that. We're nowhere near that. It still remains a tiny, tiny minority of all revenue in the U.S. legal market goes to ALSPs. Tiny, tiny, tiny proportion. And that's just not rational. It's just not rational. Doesn't make any sense, because the services they're providing are specialized labor dedicated to providing exactly what the corporates want, but at a lower price.
Again, I think we talked on it earlier that that's not where the pressure is coming from, though, until the pressure is truly on you're going to be rewarded for reducing overall cost versus you're going to be rewarded for, you know, safely removing as much risk as possible. Again, the incentives aren't necessarily there. And I bet that's going to be amazing discussion on this one.
Yeah.
You get what you reward. If you only reward risk reduction, that's all you get.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I've been reading this fantastic book, which it's mostly about a particular law firm, which did a few naughty things. But it also covers the birth of the American lawyer and mm-hmm. Steve Brill and the very, very first time that anyone ever published how much a lawyer made in a magazine, and then the creation of the Am Law 100 and how all the lawyers were pitched against each other and everyone was like jumping ship to get more and more money, and then they had to increase salaries for associates, and it just created this arms race, and everyone just became obsessed with profits and profit margins and so forth. Which perhaps, you know, it was inevitable at some point. But I guess, and this is, I guess, to me, is the third leg. I guess, so you've got the AI, you've got the ALSPs. And then the third one is, can we shift the matrix? Can we start to look at the legal market through a different lens? because up until about the 80s, I mean, it's amazing actually how short everyone's memories are, you know. But until the 80s, the idea that you would ask a law firm how much money they made would have been regarded as indecent. Mm-hmm. This thing about the birth of American law is fascinating. It was saying that people would just literally shout at the journalists and put the phone down and say, how dare you ask me how much money I make? You know, that I am a lawyer. You know, I'm a servant of the court. How dare you even think that I want to talk to you about money? But maybe we're actually at the beginning of a third era. And I don't think we're going to throw out this kind of super financially focused aspects of the law. But perhaps there's something else that comes after that, where we're looking at outcomes that are not just kind of risk versus money. There's some broader aspect there. I don't know. I'm still feeling my way through this, and I
was going to ask if you could expound on that. That's a really interesting idea.
I don't know. I'm going to ask. I'll tell you one thing. I think if we've got time, we might do a little workshop either on the 7th or the 8th during the conference. And I really want to knock that idea around. But you know, can we evaluate what we're all involved with, you know, in a different way?
Well, Richard, you've kind of answered in every question our crystal ball question, which is normally, you know, what do you project two to 5 years out? So I'm gonna kind of swap that out and ask you a different version. And so pull out your crystal ball and let us know, for the people that are attending the Legal Innovators California conference in June. What do you think the people who attend the conference are going to walk away with when it's over? And hopefully now your workshop too.
I think they'll have learned what's market, because they'll have shared with each other. They'll have learned from each other. They'll have been able to ask questions to the panels and talk to each other in the breaks and so forth. Which I think at the moment, I think understanding what's market is probably more critical than ever before, because things are moving so quickly. I think there's a real, you know, genuine, you know, tangible benefit from just being in a room with a bunch of people who work in your field and just saying, well, what on earth is going on? I think another aspect, you know, that generates value, which we touched on before, is that you've got the people on the practitioner side, private practice side, and then on the in-house side. And hopefully there's going to be some osmosis between them. They can learn from each other as well, and to actually understand the different parties' perspectives and where they've got to. It'll be very interesting, you know, particularly with stuff like AI. You know, there'll be some law firms speaking to the corporates going, you know, I read an article that you guys are actually using AI now, you know, in your business. You know, could you tell us how it's going? And, you know, there'll be, you know, vice versa, perhaps. It'll be some really, really interesting sort of like cross-fertilization between the different groups. So I think they'll be there. They'll get to meet a ton of interesting companies and ALSPs. I better not mention any particular ones, because then they'll all be very, you know, why didn't you mention my ones?
Then you're in trouble. Then you're in trouble.
You can check them out. You can see all the sponsors and all the speakers. It's all public on the website. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be exciting. And I think it'll be very positive. I think California has had a bumpy few months, let's face it, you know, hasn't it? It's we've had banks going in the wrong direction. We've had a bit of turmoil around staffing, people are wondering what's going on in all different types of areas. So I think it'd be nice to sort of come together and have sort of very positive experience and sort of look forward to doing what. I mean, everybody in that room in some way is connected to legal innovation.
Yeah.
And it's a great time to be there at the moment.
Sounds like a good time. So Richard Tromans, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. I'll make sure that I put the links out to the Legal Innovators California Conference on the show notes as well. So thanks again, Richard.
Thank you. Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Marlene. Thanks for the questions and for having me on the show.
And thank you to all of our followers, listeners, and subscribers for taking the time to listen to the Geek in Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at Gabauer M on Twitter.
And I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter. Richard, if someone wanted to find out more about you, where should they look online?
Well, for the things that I want them to know about me. Probably they should have a look at. They should have a look at artificiallawyer.com, which is the media site, the news and features. I'm on sabbatical at the moment, but there are literally hundreds upon hundreds of articles and think pieces, and also plenty of educational videos, and it's all free. So please enjoy that resource. As you just mentioned, the conference itself is on June 7th and 8th. It's in San Francisco. The website, if you want to check it out or get a ticket, is very simply, it's quite a long one, legalinnovatorscalifornia.com.
Easy peasy.
Sounds good.
Exactly. It does what it says on the tin.
And listeners, you can also leave us a voicemail on our Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Devil's back.